Indiana doesn't share a border with any foreign country, and the closest international crossing is more than 150 miles from the northeast corner of the state. But that hasn't kept Hoosiers from jumping into the national debate over immigration, or more specifically, illegal immigration. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, an expert panel weighs in on the increasingly divisive issue. Should police officers in the state be required to verify the immigration status of certain individuals suspected of being in the country illegally? Should Indiana companies who hire undocumented workers face harsher penalties? And should government agencies across the state communicate solely in English? All that and more on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue Research Park. Four locations, 200 companies, 4,000 jobs. Purdue Research Park. The idea economy is here.
At least three times in recent years, the Republican-controlled state Senate passed legislation designed to curb illegal immigration. Those measures, however, never emerged from the Democrat-dominated House, where leaders voiced concerns about racial profiling, government heavy-handedness, and the usurpation of a role that they say is best left to the federal government. Now, however, thanks to November's legislative elections, the political landscape looks a little different, and the Indiana House is now under GOP control. Is this the year that the General Assembly cracks down on illegal immigration? Joining me to discuss the issue are Representative Scott Pelath of Michigan City, Assistant Democratic Leader of the Indiana House, and former Marion County Prosecutor Carl Brizzi, a two-term Republican. And I should point out that we invited Senator Mike Delf, the Carmel Republican behind this year's legislation, to join us, but a schedule conflict prevented him from being here. I thank the two of you for being here today for this discussion. Let's set the scene for where immigration and illegal immigration fit into public policy in Indiana. Indiana is not a border state, as I pointed out at the top of the show. Why does it evoke so much passion in the state of Indiana? Scott Pelath.
Well, I tell you what, immigration evoking passion is absolutely nothing new in this country. We've always, in certain ways, I think, been a little schizophrenic about the entire issue. We're a nation of immigrants. We're very, very proud of that. We all embrace sort of our various ethnic heritage that we brought here with us. But there's always the challenges of assimilating new waves of immigrants as they come to this country. And what we're seeing going on right now with some of the emotion is no different than what happened back in the 1850s or the 1920s. It's a continual process here in this nation. I think what we always strive to do, though, is make sure that we deal with it in a sensible way that ensures that we remain all one nation, not a nation divided, and that we don't appeal to some of our worser angels, to sort of turn one of Abraham Lincoln's phrases a little bit.
And Carl Brizzi, why do you think it's such a hot button issue?
Well, you know, on my radio show on Saturday's Crime Beat, there are two issues that will light up the phones, and that is guns and immigration. And Hoosiers and people across the nation, we have folks that call the show and they are passionate about this issue on both sides of the aisle. Many of the people who are passionate about the issue are people who immigrated to this country legally and say, look, there are laws in place. We are a nation of laws. There's a way to do this. There's a right way to do this. And why do we allow one segment of the population to just continually break the law?
Let's look at how many undocumented workers or illegal aliens are in the state right now. Now, it's a hard number to come by because, by definition, it's sometimes this part of the population is not necessarily eager to be counted in a census and so forth. But if you look at the 2000 census data, granted that's a decade old now, according to that, there were about 45,000 illegals in Indiana. If you look back, though, 10 years prior to that, I think there had been about 300% growth. So if we did a linear projection, one would assume it's tens of thousands potentially of undocumented workers in the state right now. Scott Pelath, do you hear from your constituents that they are losing jobs to these individuals, or do you hear from hospitals and healthcare providers that they're being burdened by such individuals, or how big a problem is it?
Well, I tell you what, I joked with you before the show that was a punishment. The opportunity to chair sort of a full General Assembly investigation of the immigration issue a couple of years ago. And the one thing that emerges time and time again, it's almost impossible to get good data. We do know that there's been a growth in the undocumented alien population. We don't know to what extent. A good guess is it's somewhere around 80,000, but it could be as high as 120,000. And you also have to remember, too, that people are going back and forth all the time, somewhat a transient population, so you're just not sure. You know, anecdotally, some of the costs that are borne by local agencies, by hospitals, as you just mentioned, and so forth, but you never know to what extent. I just know that when I drug in all the agency heads to try to get a number on things like, just tell me how much this is costing you to do your work, they just flat out don't know. So that's a little bit of the reason I think the emotion works its way into it, because you can't get hard data, so sometimes the imagination then fills in the absences of information.
Well, when you don't have a quantifiable target or one that's easily quantifiable, does it make it that much tougher to develop public policy to address a perceived problem?
Well, certainly in the area of law enforcement, when you have an undocumented population, there are inherent suspicions that go along with folks that are from, let's just say Mexico, for instance. There are language barriers, there are custom barriers, and what happens a lot of times is that they become victims of predators, whether they be Hispanic street gangs, whatever it might be, because they know that this undocumented population, they're afraid to come forward. They're afraid of what might happen to them. And so when I was prosecutor, we were dealing with this issue all of the time, not only saying, look, we will protect you, right, because we don't want these people to be preyed upon, but at the same time, don't not come forward because you're afraid that, you know, we're going to report you to Immigration Customs Enforcement, or because you're afraid of the language barriers and that sort of thing. So that certainly does have a real quantifiable cost.
Now, you both pointed out that this is an issue that gets people really worked up, and it's an ongoing issue, but one reason we're talking about it this week, of course, two things really brought it into the headlines this week. One was the passage by the Senate Pensions and Labor Committee on, I believe, a 7-1 vote of Mike Delf's bill, which is Senate Bill 590. The other one was the same day, also on Wednesday, when a coalition involving or representing higher education, health care, religion, the business community came together to have a ceremonial signing of the Indiana Compact, which basically says, and this is a gross distillation of it, but leave it to the federal government.
Butt out.
Is the bottom line. That's an even better distillation, I suppose. Let's start with Senate Bill 590,
sure.
And let's start with the law enforcement component. That's something, of course, that Carl Brizzi just mentioned. That part of the bill is patterned after what we have seen creating so much controversy in Arizona.
Right.
And as I understand it, if I'm a police officer under this proposed legislation and I stop you for a traffic violation, you run a red light, make an illegal right turn, and I have any suspicion that you are here illegally, it's incumbent on me, I'm required to get proof of your immigration status. Is that?
I tell you what, one thing that happened this week over on the House side that really gave me cause for concern, you know, I sit on the Ways and Means Committee and we were conducting our budget hearings, and our state police superintendent came in to testify and talk about the dollars that he needed for the coming couple of years. And I asked him pointedly that if he was monitoring this immigration legislation that went through, how would it affect his job? And he was, I thought, very emphatic that, one, it would bust their budget, two, they wouldn't be able to do it, and three, if they work with the federal government to do these things, the federal government probably wouldn't be that interested because they have so much of their own work to do. They can round people up and detain them. The federal government doesn't really have the capacity to process them in the way that they need to. So, bottom line, it's something that states are very poorly equipped to handle. And it convinced me even more, as maybe we heard from the business community a little bit, it is a federal issue. It historically has been, it constitutionally has been, and we should give them all the blame, criticism, or praise that they're entitled to and that they warrant in order to improve what exists for all 50 states right now.
You mentioned the cost. There is a fiscal note on this bill in terms of the impact on state police, I believe, of about $5 million, which is why, incidentally, this bill will have to go to Senate Appropriations next before it can get to the Senate floor.
And it's not just about the raw dollars and cents. It's also about the diversion of activity. As Carl just said, there's challenges down there on the street with what you have to focus on. And any distraction from that could cause other crimes to be not enforced as well.
Well, Carl Brizzi, you've lived in the law enforcement trenches. You spent 8 years as Marion County prosecutor. You just talked about the need to protect the immigrant population. How about this notion that we're mimicking or potentially mimicking Arizona and saying, police officers, you have now have an additional obligation. You need to find out where these people are from if you have any suspicion.
Look, here's the difference between Indiana and Arizona. What border state are we trying to protect ourselves from? Ohio, Kentucky, Illinois? I mean, where are these tunnels where these residents from other states are trying to come into the country? Indiana's not Arizona. I've studied this issue. I've had Sheriff Joe Arapo on my show. I've talked to these legislators out in Arizona.
He's the sheriff, the infamous sheriff who has the inmates wear pink and is
Maricopa County.
Maricopa County,
yeah.
Right.
But they are a state in crisis. Those border towns are in crisis. There are people running drugs back and forth the border. There are sex predators and other people coming across those borders that are unsecured. And the citizens of Arizona have said, look, yes, it's the federal government's prerogative, but they're not doing their job. And so we, as citizens of Arizona, need to step up and fill in the gaps. I don't see Indiana being similarly situated.
So from your perspective, and again, you saw this firsthand day after day for 8 years, you don't think Indiana police officers should be saddled with this additional obligation?
I do not think that it's going to make a discernible difference. I think that if there's a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, that's one thing. And if you're in this country illegally and you are arrested and convicted of any crime, that ought to be reported to Immigration Customs Enforcement, and those people ought to be deported. If you're here illegally, you don't get a second, a third, a fourth bite at the apple. You need to be deported. But to go out and actively pursue this kind of thing, we don't have the resources.
So no discernible difference, in your opinion, and a lot more expense, literally and figuratively, as you point out, Scott Peleth. What about the notion that critics raise often about racial profiling, just the basic fairness issue, that if you're an Irish immigrant or mm-hmm. you've snuck across from Ontario, Canada, you know, and you're here illegally in Indiana, you're much less likely, one would imagine, to have someone ask you for your papers.
Well, and that feeds back into the emotion of it, too, because that's an area that's very easy for people to understand. And they realistically ask the question, look, would illegal immigrants from Canada be treated the same way? And that, by the way, is one thing that makes making reasonable changes in the immigration system very difficult to do, because you do have those sorts of emotional underpinnings on very hot-button issues that sort of naturally work their way into the issue. But I tell you what, I was looking at this a couple years ago. There ought to be some very common-sense things that we ought to agree on that don't alienate anybody, that I think broadly you should be able to find a consensus on common-sense changes that wouldn't cost a ton of money. It's looking at things like, Should you look at it in an e-verify system and maybe ask employers to help participate in making sure that they're not unwittingly hiring illegal workers? That's something that's worth continuing to look at. Should you maybe, in the business community, it's hard to sort of put too much burden on them, but if you have a repeat violator that the immigration enforcement agencies have identified, should you maybe look at taking some action against them? That may make sense in some certain ways. So I think there's some things we can do, but we have to avoid, again, I think putting those most emotional things in there, and most costly emotional things certainly need to be kept out.
And I definitely want to get to the business component of this,
right,
because that is a big element of Mike Delf's bill. One more question about law enforcement. As a lawyer, as somebody who's practiced in this field, Carl Brizzi, is there a constitutionally valid way, in your opinion, for police officers to check based on probable suspicion of immigration status without racial profiling? Because the bill does say you can't look at ethnicity or race.
Right, but you know, we throw out this broad term, racial profiling. Profiling happens all the time in our country, whether it's narcotics stops, That is a tool law enforcement uses. It's not based on the color of your skin, but it's based on activity, suspicious activity. And that is the way that law enforcement can go about actually looking for people who are here illegally, who are breaking the laws, right? We don't have infinite resources to go after every illegal person, every undocumented person. But if those undocumented people, the ones causing the problems, the ones preying upon our children, the ones committing the crimes. Those are the people that law enforcement ought to be going after.
All right. To the business community, Scott Pialath, you just set the stage for that a moment ago. The bill that we're talking about, Senate Bill 590, would put a new burden, an additional burden on business, Indiana businesses, to effectively screen their prospective hires. And initially, as it was filed, the bill would have basically provided a three-strike-and-you're-out provision where if an employer knowingly violated the statute and hired illegals, undocumented workers, three times, they might have their license to do business revoked. That was watered down a bit in committee this past week, so that basically if you're an offender, the company would lose its tax deductions mm-hmm. that are tied to that particular employee. Even with the softening, if you will, is that an appropriate way to deal with business? A moment ago, you did say right. This may be the way to go with E-Verify and other approaches.
Well, look, here's the reality. Something probably with the current composition of the legislature is going to happen on the illegal immigration issue. I just can't believe that the now Republican-led Senate and Republican-led House won't want to pass legislation in some form. Given that fact, I think we should look for ways to make things work better. And some softening and modification of this is probably going to be necessary. But is an E-Verify requirement something to be rejected out of hand? No, I think probably not. You know, as legislators, we all have what we call real jobs. My real job, I hire people for a living. I'm an HR director. I'm not sure I would see that as a huge burden, having to run an additional electronic check. You're already doing those things anyways. You're trying to make sure you're not hiring pedophiles or people with felonies or anyone in those categories. So then I think, given that it's probably not a huge burden, it comes down to what the quality of the system is and whether you're going to inadvertently harm anybody that maybe should get a job otherwise. And that's really just then gets down to being a technical issue. And I think those are maybe the types of things we can work through. I think, though, particularly on my side of the aisle, what we tend to want to shy away from is things that seem mean. Philosophically, we've tended to believe that it ought to be about maybe asking a little more participation from businesses, cracking down on bad actors, but not maybe preventing someone who may be here, unfortunately, or lured here with a low-wage job from being overly punitive towards them, because the federal laws deal with that anyways.
Well, now the business community has come out against this, or at least certain groups that represent the business interests, the Indiana State Chamber, Bankers Association, to name a few, are signatories to the Indiana Compact that I alluded to a few moments ago.
What do they say, though? What's their justification for wanting to hire
immigrants? Well, the chamber talks about the economic impact that immigrants bring to Indiana. They say it's a $10 billion a year impact.
Then it ought to be legal.
Taxes paid $2.3 billion. They say 160,000 immigrants work in the state. I guess you could say, if you want to get to the heart of the matter, if you look at some of the figures from workforce development at the state level, they say one-third, perhaps, of farm workers in the state are undocumented workers. I mean, is there a potential threat to the function of business in the agribusiness community, for instance?
If there is, if that's a legitimate point, then we as a state ought to address that, right? I mean, why would we say let's not enforce the law because it may have a negative economic impact? Change the law to benefit the state, but to ignore the law and come up with some idea that the federal government is somehow going to do the job, we know that's not going to happen, only because of past practices, right? It hasn't happened so far. Why do we think it's going to happen? I can tell you as a prosecutor, when I was dealing with Immigration Customs Enforcement, they are woefully understaffed. We have a hard time getting them to deport registered sex offenders, violent felons. So why do we think that they're going to enforce a law against employers who are knowingly hiring illegal aliens? And if we don't want that to be policy, then we ought to just change the law to comport with what we need as a state.
All right. We're running out of time, but I do want to talk about the notion that government agencies at the state and local level under this legislation would have to communicate in English, solely in English, whether that's tax forms or government documents. Good idea. Actually, the House already passed another bill that Suzanne Crouch from Evansville offered by a fairly comfortable margin that would make, I guess Indiana's already, it's already the official language, has been since 84, but this would put teeth in that, supposedly.
I saw this bill show up in the calendar, and I thought, well, maybe it's going to save a lot of money or Maybe we're having a bunch of government documents issued in Swahili, and we'll be able to not have those printing costs any longer. The fact of the matter is, I voted against the bill because it means nothing and it does nothing. There's not a major problem with documents being issued in languages other than English. The proponents couldn't tell me what documents are issued in languages other than English, and they couldn't tell me what the savings would be. Even the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency said there is no fiscal impact to the legislative or to the legislation. So it's just one of those things that kind of gets people fired up and is maybe fun to talk about for a few minutes, but it has no practical impact on the state of Indiana.
And Carl Brizzi, how about this notion that we need to speak English and English only if we're in government?
Well, my kids go to school in Washington Township, and I guarantee you that half the population, if not more, is Hispanic, and they speak Spanish, right? So I think this is more symbolic than anything else, and I would agree that it's not a huge issue. And I think it kind of makes us a little prehistoric in a way. I mean, we have been dealing with this for decades now, and it's not going to go away. But at the same time, this is why it's a complicated issue. If you're in France or if you're in another country and they ask for your passport when you check into a hotel, you got to turn it over. I mean, so there are some legitimate restrictions on foreign activity, but this kind of stuff is just doesn't cut it, I don't think.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. A very fascinating issue. I appreciate the input that both of you have offered during this discussion. Again, my guests have been Representative Scott Pilath, a Michigan City Democrat, and former Marion County Prosecutor Carl Brizzi, a Republican. On the next Indiana Lawmakers, with Indiana's prison population soaring, is it time to revise the state's sentencing laws? To join the discussion or pose a question for our guests, visit the Indiana Lawmakers discussion on the WFYI Facebook page. Each week, I'll select one of your questions for our panel of experts. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight. Well, Ed, as Carl Brizzi pointed out a couple times, we're not a border state. We're not at war with anybody. No Kentucky jokes, please, at this point. But I'll ask you the same question I ask them. Why is this so politically charged? Why is there this passion behind this push for legislation?
Well, I'm not going to pretend that this goes back to 1863 and Morgan's Raiders and all that, but you know, there is a long history of Indiana kind of protecting its own borders and being afraid of other cultures, states, institutions, whatever, and this is probably an extension of that. And you know, Governor Oliver Morton took the lead back in 1863 on this, and you know, here we are many years later, and Governor Daniels may even be trying to avoid getting involved in this at this point.
Well, you know, the battle lines are clearly developing here. This week we saw, as I noted earlier in the show, the emergence of the signing, if you will, of the Indiana Compact, this provision calling for a statement of five principles saying, leave this to the federal government. Some predictable people on as part of that group, and maybe some less predictable people involved, including the Attorney General, the Republican Attorney General of Indiana, Greg Zeller. Were you surprised that he is part of that movement of saying, leave this issue alone for now?
Well, I think he understands what law enforcement is all about and what different responsibilities are invested in different agencies and different levels of government. And I'm sure that he's frustrated, just like some of the folks in the Indiana State Police are frustrated, just like Carl Brizzi indicated he was frustrated as a local prosecutor, but he understands that primary enforcement for this right now, at least, is vested in the federal government, and the federal government should be devoting the resources to it. And in fact, you heard from Senator Delf at the hearing that, you know, if the federal government were doing its job, we wouldn't have to step in. And I think what Attorney General Zeller is saying is, you know, maybe the feds ought to step up what they're supposed to be doing so that we don't have to get involved in this in their place.
You know, given that there are such strong feelings on both sides, I was surprised by the vote when this came out of the Senate Pensions and Labor Committee. It was 7-1, I think, with Karen Tallien, Senator from Portage, a Democrat, the only no vote. Are people afraid to vote against this in this political climate?
Well, actually, this first committee vote, John, was an easy one for anyone who wanted some political cover, because this bill is not going to pass in its final form as we saw it in the committee hearing on Wednesday. There's going to be a lot of work done on this thing. It's going to cost a lot of money to actually implement, and that will probably be the death of most of those provisions in the Senate Appropriations Committee. And then when the House gets a hold of it and the House Committee on Ways and Means looks at it and looks at the fiscal impact, there'll be some concerns raised there. And yes, you may have some provisions of this bill that ultimately find their way into law, perhaps some of the E-Verify things for business and for state government. But I think in general, you're going to look at just a very limited number of these things being enacted.
And you mentioned Mitch Daniels, this perhaps not being something he wants to deal with. What happened to the truce, dealing only with economic issues?
He declared that truce, but legislators, I think, this past week showed that they can walk and chew gum at the same time. And that was something that they said to the governor right up front. They said, let us tackle these things. They won't get in the way of our other economic issues that we need to address and things like redistricting, which they need to get done this session. I think this last week proved that you can deal with some of these big issues in a passionate yet not destructive kind of an environment.
All right, Ed, we'll leave it there and we'll see you next week.
For more information, episode streams, and extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Lawmakers under News. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis. Thank you.
What happens when bright ideas meet world-class infrastructure?
You can discover new ways to treat cancer.
Understand our planet.
Understand our galaxy.
To learn more, visit PurdueResearchPark.com.